Every 10 seconds, a new small business is started. Every day, more and more people are deciding they want to be their own boss and making huge sacrifices to live out their dreams. Yet, they have no place to turn for support. Entrepreneurs of the world, unite and let's talk business.
This is Dr. Dennis Waitley. You're listening to Let's Talk Business, which I think is probably the most important show that you can listen to on becoming an entrepreneur in a fast-forward world.
The Let's Talk Business Network is dedicated to helping entrepreneurs and small business owners succeed. So get ready to be helped, informed, and inspired, because it's time for Let's Talk Business with veteran entrepreneur and a man who was voted one of the 100 most important talk show hosts, Mitch Schlimmer.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Let's Talk Business. I'm your host, Mitch Schlimmer, here from beautiful Atlanta. Just a wonderful city, especially for entrepreneurship. And right here, heard every Saturday on 91.1 on your FM dial, WREK. And one of the things that many of my listeners know is that I love to bring on guests that may be a little bit ahead of the curve. And more importantly, their companies and the work they've done and their journey can help you. And I've been saying for a while, there's a lot of change going on in the economy and obviously for entrepreneurs, both domestically and internationally. And our two guests really address this in their own way. My first featured guest is joining us from Golden, Colorado, and it's Dr. Lori Bassey. And we're going to talk about many things, but especially her book that she has co-authored called Good Company: Business Success in the Worthiness Area. And then afterwards, Jill Kornrath is going to join us from Minnesota. And we're going to talk all about sales, but there's a lot going on in the world as it relates to sales. Things are not the same, and I know for many, a lot more difficult. And hopefully, my interview with Jill is going to help you, and more importantly, will encourage you to go out and get her book called Snap Selling: Speed Up Sales and Win More Business with Today's Frazzled Customers. Well, as I mentioned, my first guest is Dr. Lori Bassey, and she also runs her own business. She is the CEO and co-founder of McBassey & Company. She also actually is chair of the board of Bassey Investments, and she's a leading authority on the emerging decision science of human capital management, which is the process and practices within an organization that align the management and development of employees with its business results. And she has no shortage of wonderful clients and degrees from some really prestigious schools, including back in the mid-80s, she received her PhD in economics from Princeton. Lori, welcome to Let's Talk Business.
Thanks so much, Mitch. Delighted to be here with you.
How you doing?
Great. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to have you. And as I opened up, I think there's a lot of change going on in the world. And I think that you have clearly recognized this along with the others at your company. And I always try and get the sense also for the journey of my guests. And I thought it would be great to, maybe go back. You know, you just got your PhD in economics, and talk a little bit about your journey and how it led you to here today and coming up with this book, Good Company.
Well, you know, it's been a long journey, Mitch, but I'll try to tell the short version of it. It started about 30 years ago when I was a graduate student at Princeton, and you know, kind of had these muddled thoughts about how could I contribute to a better world, and those thoughts continued to be muddled until a very important kind of life-changing conversation that I had in 1988. I found myself in a steel mill in Western Maryland, and although I was a certified card-carrying PhD in labor economics, I had never been in a workplace like this. It was hot, dirty, dangerous, and kind of a hostile work environment. And I was there interviewing workers about their, quote, learning environment. And my job was to take these interviews and translate them into quantified, coded data, because the incentives were very clear for me as a young, newly minted PhD in economics. as an academic, I had to publish prestigious papers and get tenure. And that meant doing highly mathematical, sophisticated, quantitative analysis. So there I am interviewing these workers, and for the most part, they were all very pleasant and compliant, but you know, really, there wasn't much of a learning environment to talk about, but they answered my questions as best they could. But apparently, in the last interview, I asked one question too many, and the gentleman said to me, look, ma'am, I can sum it up for you in a nutshell. I go home at the end of every day, whooped, tired, and disgusted. And that pretty much ended the interview. And as I drove home that night, the words played over and over in my head, and I realized no amount of sophisticated econometric analysis could really capture the raw power of what the man had said to me, really the raw horror of what he had said to me. And so over the weeks and months that followed, that those words really kind of permeated into my soul and really altered the way I thought about my work. And it wasn't just about publishing fancy papers and getting tenure. It was really about the quality of people's lives and how our workplaces and our places of business really have such a profound impact on people's lives, for good or for ill, and ultimately the society in which we all live. And that was the conversation that got me started on this path that ultimately led to this book.
Well, I tell you what, you start on this path, and obviously there's lots of other things that you've done along the way, including, if I remember right, being an assistant professor of economics at Georgetown in the mid-'80s as well. Obviously the co-writers and the partners, at McBassey have come up, with a lot of really interesting ideas. But, you think back to Jim Collins's book, Good to Great, and that brought a lot of attention to that good isn't good enough. And I know you have a whole different feeling to some extent about what a good company is. And it leads into, what really is a good company and what is this worthiness era?
So while we're great admirers of Jim Collins' work, the basic message of good company is you can't be great these days unless you're good. And by being good, we mean a company that is good to its employees, good to its customers, a good steward of the communities in which it works and the environment. And that is the combination that produces great results.
What about specifically, and I think this is a big finding of yours, is this whole, worthiness era, what this is. And, I can hear a lot of people also, Lori, actually saying, I got a good company. I mean, of course I take good care of my employees, and of course I care about my customers. I'm not an idiot, but the brutal fact of the matter is I think you've seen things differently, especially in big companies, and it shows up obviously in your index. So I thought it'd be great for you to really talk about, what this worthiness era is, and maybe talk to those that really think, I got a good company.
Yep. Okay. Well, first of all, what we mean by the worthiness era is that we are entering into this economic era where there really is a huge economic premium to being good, to being a good company. And the forces behind that, there's a convergence of forces, economic, social, and political, that is actually forcing companies to become good companies in our lives. I think you could really sum it up in a nutshell. The primary force is really technology-enabled people power. People have a lot more power than they used to. And even though we're in a period of high unemployment, the balance of power is shifting from large corporations to employees and customers, and quite frankly, the little guys. So yeah, while a lot of people on the phone are saying, we're a good company, we do all of those three things right. We're a good employer, good seller, good steward. Absolutely. I do think this economic era actually favors the little guys. It is easier to get it right when you're a little guy. It's hard to do all of this well when you're a big guy, especially the publicly traded guys, because they're subject to the pressures of Wall Street, which, really create a short-run myopic focus, which causes a lot of corner cutting sometimes. So So in some ways, I think the little guys are really positioned to thrive in this emerging worthiness era.
Well, maybe you could expand on that, and let's say you're starting out. Maybe you can give them, you know, what I might call some platform, you know, methodologies to really starting out right away, building a good company and really taking advantage of what you have really discovered. And that's how I opened up the show. The show is about really highlighting change going on and this, you know, this worthiness era.
So I think there are a couple ways to tackle that, Mitch. One is kind of from an intangible attribute perspective, and the other is sort of much more tangibly and concretely. So let me talk about the first one and then, you know, see where you want to take the conversation from there. We believe the fundamental intangible attribute of good companies in this worthiness era is something we call reciprocity. Really focusing on not just on win-win, but, you know, on win-win-win or even win-win-win-win. We call it all win. That, you know, or kind of a new phrase that we're coining here, that really a focus on creating wins for all of the stakeholders in your business is essential. That is the foundational attribute. You know, there are other intangible attributes which we outline in the book, connectivity, the fundamental need and emergent power of human beings to be connected and informed and effective. That's a very important attribute to build into your business: transparency, balance, and courage. Those are really the five intangible attributes that we identify as a good, a worthy company. But, you know, if you're interested, I can also kind of launch into some of the more specific, you know, so how do you actually do that kind of stuff?
I think that would be great. I think giving our listeners, again, CEOs and entrepreneurs, those kinds of tangibles is why we're here. And again, we're here and you're listening to Let's Talk Business right here on WREK 91.1 on your FM dial. And I always love to get your emails. We're always here to help you. Always feel free to send email to mitch@ltbn.com. That's mitch@ltbn.com. And you can learn all about Lori's company also at www.mcbassi.com. So, Lori, let's go ahead and get specific and talk about some of these tangibles.
You know, and before I dive into that, let me also mention the book's website, Mitch, which is goodcompanyindex.com. A lot of cool stuff on there, free resources, including what I think is this very cool grading system that we use to grade the Fortune 100 A to F. So that's a great resource, I think, for your listeners. So on the more tangible front, what does it really mean? How do you do this? Well, first of all, the good employer pillar, remembering we've got three pillars: good employer, good seller, and good steward. Good employer is absolutely foundational. You can't be a good seller for long. You can't be a steward to your community and the environment unless you get this good employer thing down. So that's really where I would suggest that people focus, and kind of on three big areas. One is being an organization that is value created and committed to employees. You know, it's kind of you get what you give here. So some of the notions that have permeated Wall Street in the past, you know, disposable workers, you know, it's really changed kind of the implicit contract of work in America. That, we believe, has been very, very damaging. You know, you have to create some kind of commitment to employees. That doesn't mean you give them a lifetime guarantee, but certainly one of the things that you can do to help employees and to help your business is really to focus on their development, because that really is a win-win. So we have a whole chapter in the book that's devoted to that. Good employers, you really need to be focused on creating value and being committed to your employees. And, you know, quite frankly, you need to have an inspiring purpose. It has to go beyond just making money. So you need to be really clear and articulate on what is the purpose of your business beyond making money. And obviously, making money is essential, but there has to be a purpose beyond that if you really are going to inspire the best efforts And then third, we say, you know, and you've got to run this the people side of your business in a business-like way. So especially as entrepreneurs start to get larger, you know, going beyond really the small business, as you get to be a medium and larger business, you need to get the people side of the business right. It's not enough to run it by gut and intuition. You actually need to create some actionable business intelligence. And that's what we call this, you know, this emerging science of people management that you referenced in your introduction to me. So those are the three pillars of being a good employer, which is foundational to being a good company.
Well, I think also one of the things that I really liked about the book and things that you also say, you know, a lot of people think they are, you know, socially responsible. But as we both know, being socially responsible in this day and age, Lori, is not good enough.
Yeah, the bar, quite frankly, has been set pretty low heretofore. And I think, Mitch, the bar is getting raised. That's really, you know, the message of the book.
I think it is the message of the book, and that's why I have you on today, is I think things are drastically changing, including in the world of sales as well. And we're going to be covering that later on today with Jill Kornrath, and we're talking about her latest book called Snap Selling. But, you know, one thing I also thought would be great is in getting very specific, and we kind of talked about this, but maybe we could even get a little bit more granular, and maybe, you know, what is really needed, and you know, what should an entrepreneur really do here to really build a good and worthy company?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talked about this notion of reciprocity, and you know, this phrase that we're coming up with of all win. You know, could bake that into all your thinking, all your strategy. You know, how can we create win-win? Because that's how you create, you know, enthusiastic supporters through employees and customers and investors, if you have them. The other, I would say the next thing that I would list really is transparency, because that is really what the, you know, fundamentally driving, forcing companies, some of which haven't always been so good, to become better, is that there is an unbelievable level of transparency. You know, it's pretty hard to hide anything. And we tell a lot of stories in the book about how, you know, a single anonymous blogger has changed a whole industry. You know, a blogger complaining about her spouse being overworked in the ridiculous hours. And it just, you know, it just led to, it went viral. And know, really forced this whole industry and big firms to re-examine what they were doing. So there is this incredible transparency. You can't hide the bad stuff anymore. And once again, I think that's, you know, that's beneficial for good companies, because their customers know, you know, it's hard to hide things when you're a small firm. So in this newly transparent world where the web and technology is enabling customers and employees to kind of know everything about you, you know, there's your dirty laundry is going to get out there. So really focusing on is the action that I'm taking right now, are the words that I'm saying right now, would I be pleased to have that on the front page of the New York Times or, you know, the Financial Times or splattered all over the web, or would that be an embarrassment to me? You know, if you kind of embed that in your thinking, that's the world we live in, I think you'll create a good company that way.
Let's say that you are the CEO of a company and you're also the entrepreneur and founder, and you say, oh my God, you know, this is what I've been feeling for a long time, and I know I need to initiate this, but I've got, you know, a certain kind of culture, and what advice would you give them in order to really deal with and talk to and communicate with their organization and start building this new kind of, you know, good company in this worthiness era?
Well, you know, Mitch, there's just nothing quite like the truth. So if you find yourself in an environment, either one that you have created or you've inherited, where the culture really just isn't what you think you would want or what employees want, you know, I think just have a real frank, open conversation about that for starters. You know, especially that's very doable in small firms. Just pulling people together and say, hey, folks, here's what I see. Is that what you see? How do you see it differently? And, you know, just an open two-way dialogue does remarkable things.
No, I think open communications, obviously, is really important. You know, when you read the book, and, you know, you talked about earlier, you know, your, you know, mathematics and all that goes into being an economist, you know, a lot of these findings are steeped in real facts, especially the studies that you've done, you know, and even these indexes, you know, whether it's the KLD 400 social index and so on and so forth. I thought it might be good for you to briefly talk about some of these indexes and some of the findings that that you were able to see and how these companies, you know, like Disney, who follow this, actually perform better.
Yes, I love this part of the book. I think this is probably one of the sexiest parts of the book. We actually assign a grade, as I mentioned, A to F, each of the Fortune 100, and we do that. This is kind of just our first pass at it. It was pretty challenging to get this together for the first time, but we hope in the future to be able to expand this. So, you know, quantitative economists try to be very objective, so we actually have empirical methodologies for looking at how good an employer is, how good the firm is as a seller, and how good it is as a steward. We have 11 data feeds that go into that, and ultimately assign, based on that, a grade of A to F, as I said. Then we look within matched pairs in the Fortune 100, firms that are in the same industry. For example, Citigroup versus Wells Fargo, or Walgreens versus CVS. And so we ask the question, within these matched pairs, these firms are working in the same industry, they're subject to the same market forces, who performs better, the good company, the one with the higher grade, or the less worthy counterpart? And the evidence is really quite amazing. Over the past three-year period, the good companies outperformed their less worthy counterparts by 10 percentage points per year in the stock market, which is astonishingly large. And in the last year alone, Since the time that's unfolded when we created the index, finalized the index of June of 2010, in this last year, the good companies have outperformed their counterpart in the stock market by 19.8%. So, you know, this tells us that this, you know, this isn't fluffy feel-good stuff, although hopefully, it is that as well. But it is hard-nosed economic evidence that there really is a very substantial payoff to being a good company, and it may even be increasing, which we suspect it is.
And it is even in these times, and that's a whole other, you know, angle that's really interesting. But one of my favorite parts of all of these findings, Lori, is nice guys don't finish last.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah, it's good news for the good guys.
It's really good news. I think a lot of people, you know, are so bottom line driven that they don't realize that, you know, doing good for employees, doing good for mankind, doing good for our youth, pays back handsomely. And sometimes you hear what goes around comes around, karma, it doesn't really matter. But what this book pointed out and what you just brought up is that the statistical data proving that when you behave this way and it's a part of your DNA, you're going to do better as well. Just some great stuff.
Yeah, it is a very hopeful message, but it is not a soft-headed message.
And it's not one to take lightly, and I don't think it's something you can say, oh, my God, guys, you know, this is what we got to do, and you go around, you know, to some extent, maybe faking it a little. You really have to believe this in every cell in your body, and hopefully you agree.
Absolutely, and you know, I think it's partly this transparency, or in large part this transparency, that faking it is getting more and more difficult in the world.
People are smart, and they can see through it. You know, one of the things you know you talk about, you know, is a turnaround whereby firms that have tried to insulate themselves into our lives as friends or family are now getting more attention from people than they ever even wanted. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, for example, we start the book off with what I think is a very interesting story about Home Depot back in 2007. You know, you can do it, we can help. That's what they've promised. And this is one of these examples of a blogger started to complain about the fact that Home Depot was really almost taking advantage of its customers. You know, the stores were dirty, you couldn't find anybody to help you. They had, you know, an incredibly highly paid CEO who wasn't producing the goods for really anybody. So this blogger, you know, wrote a simple blog entry, very short actually, and within a week there were 4,000 responses. You know, such, almost all of them negative. So the new CEO who had just been brought in was actually forced to respond in a very public, you know, very soul-bearing, very authentic way directly to this blogger, you know, thanking him for calling attention to this and, you know, what they were going to do in response to it. So here's a company, you know, that invited us or asked us to invite them into their lives. You can do it. We can help. They weren't making good on the promise, and they got called on it in a very public way. So the journey of Home Depot over the last few years, I think, is really a great example. You know, not that they're perfect, but they've turned things around.
They have turned things around, and that's what a good CEO can do. But just on a whole other note, as we both know, the old CEO got quite an incredible compensation package,
right?
over $200 million, which still blows my mind.
Yes, and, you know, it clearly irked a lot of folks. But, you know, Home Depot did learn from that. Their next CEO had a much more reasonable package. There's an example of a company that I think is learning.
They are learning, and no one's perfect. And your overall point is the consumer will let you know and can let you know in all kinds of ways. And it's great to take care of them versus cut back so much that the kind of customer service that you expected, you know, isn't gone. But in starting to wrap up here, Lori, I thought, what was some of maybe the most surprising or even interesting things you learned while co-writing Good Company?
I'd say three things, Mitch. First of all, the level of illegality borderline illegality among the Fortune 100 was depressing and astonishing. We created a database of all of the major fines and penalties against the Fortune 100. This has never been done before, you know, to put this information all in one place. It was shocking and distressing. Number two, and on the flip side of that, we also compiled information on the good things that these companies are doing, the how they're using their core capabilities to really contribute, not making money, to the communities in which they work. You know, Walmart, a $2 billion campaign to end hunger in the United States. You know, very, very impressive, using its core capabilities to solve pressing problems. And number three, then, so, you know, there was bad news, there was good news, and then this finding, this empirical quantitative finding relating measures of firms' goodness to their economic performance is really very, very compelling. And quite frankly, you know, as an economist, I'm surprised to find this. So that was maybe the funnest part of the book, is kind of unearthing that.
Hey, Lori, why was that interesting for you to find that out? Why didn't you expect that?
Oh, so there's an economic theory, and I'll try to be very brief about it. It's called the random walk. And economist theory of the stock market is it follows a random walk. That is to say, it's systematically impossible to predict future stock prices. Why? Because there are a lot of really, really smart people whose job it is to do that. And so when information becomes available about a publicly traded firm, it becomes quickly incorporated into the current price and therefore ceases to predict the future. So the bottom line of the random walk theory is that you shouldn't be able to predict stock prices. But we have. And it, by the way, it's something we've been working on in a more narrow way for almost 15 years now. And we've found that this people stuff and now this good company stuff powerful, powerful predictors of stock prices. Wall Street isn't paying attention to the important stuff, is what that tells us. And by the way, this is not idle chatter. As you mentioned, I run a small investment company where we actually invest live money under management, our own, on the principles of this book.
And that, to me, says it all. So real quickly here, 30 seconds or so, maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, the future, but more importantly, you know, how it relates to entrepreneurs and how they can go ahead and really be this really good company.
You know, Mitch, I think it's a very hopeful time for entrepreneurs. These forces that we're describing favor the good guys. It's easier to be a good guy if you're a small guy. It's a very hopeful message for entrepreneurs and, I think, for employees. You know, at a time when, quite frankly, this nation could use some good news. So it's, you know, hopeful message, but as I said, not a soft-headed one.
Not a soft-headed one as well. And again, I firmly believe, even when we talk about entrepreneurs of the world unite, and I think even dreamers unite, that entrepreneurs are the ones that are going to help get us out of this. And that's what this show is all about. Again, listeners, you're listening to Let's Talk Business, all about entrepreneurship, small business, innovation, and youth empowerment. And you're listening to us right here on WREK 91.1 on your FM dial. My guest has been Dr. Laurie Bassi. We've been talking about her book. Barrett Cole is the publisher. Go out and get it. Good company, business success in the worthiness era. Laurie, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Mitch, thanks for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Great, and hopefully you enjoyed yourself.
I did. It was great fun. Thanks for making it fun.
Okay, all right, listeners. Well, my next featured guest is Jill Conrath. Actually, has a fascinating journey and is also a fellow business owner. And she's got a really wonderful niche. She's an author and a speaker and a strategist and much, much more. And she's written some marvelous books, including her latest book that's been out called Snap Selling, Speed Up Sales and Win More Business with Today's Frazzled Customers. And it's so nice to have her join us here. Jill, welcome to Let's Talk Business.
Well, thank you for having me. It's fun to be here today.
It's exciting to have you. And today I opened up with a very clear indication of what the show would be about. And that's to get some forward thinkers who have also recognized things have changed dramatically in all disciplines of business and entrepreneurship, and that includes sales. And I thought it would be great to have you on because, as you say, you know, we'll call it a philosophy that in today's crazy business environment, a company's only sustainable competitive advantage is its sales force. And sales is so important for entrepreneurs. And I thought it'd be great, we have a half hour here, to start off and talk a little bit about your journey and how you got here today. And maybe we could go all the way back to, you know, where eventually you got your first job there at Xerox.
Okay, let me start you back a little bit earlier, okay? Because I actually began my career as a high school teacher. And I wasn't real happy with that, and this is how I got into what I'm doing today. I decided to leave teaching and to actually start a company of my own. And I had come up with a really, really good business idea. I brought it to the SBA, the SCORE group, and they looked at it, and they said, you know, this is really a timely idea. And then there were three of us that had gone in together, and they said, looked at the three of us, and they said, now which one of you is going to sell it? And the three of us looked at each other, and ultimately I spoke up, and I said, well, I thought you said this was such a good idea. And he said, well, it is, but somebody has to sell it. And the truth of the matter is I lost. You know, I was the one of the three that was told to go into sales and figure it out. And so I went into sales begrudgingly only because I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I needed to learn it in order to be successful as an entrepreneur. And so that's when I ended up getting the job at Xerox.
Which is a great company, as we both know, especially if you want to learn all about sales. So let's start off where you know, naturally you're an introvert, as you and I know, and you're now at Xerox. Let's talk a little bit about that journey and how it got you up to writing your first book and then Snap Selling.
Sure. I mean, my first territory with Xerox, I was selling copiers, and I was selling in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in a suburb that had never been successful before, but they didn't tell me that. And I just knew that I wanted to figure this thing out called sales, and so I just worked my tail off and experimented and tried different things, and I mean, ultimately became extremely successful, much to my surprise, because I wasn't a salesy type of person, and was promoted rapidly into management, and then left Xerox to go with a technology company, because I really thought it would be important to understand technology, and if I put myself in the position of having to sell it, I do learn much faster. And then after that, I sold technology for 3 years, then I started my own company and was selling business services. And so that's been since the mid-1980s that I've had my own business and consider myself an entrepreneur today, too.
Well, you are an entrepreneur, and as you and I both know, there's lots of highs and lows and wins and failures, and you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, some of those tough times, because I think those tough times define you and help catapult you to that next level, including writing your first book.
Yeah, the truth of the matter is, I mean, I was recently asked to speak at a conference, and I was talking to a group of young salespeople, and the owner of this entrepreneurial firm said to me, Jill, will you talk about your first few years in this business? And I actually had to stop and think, because it had been a long time since my first few years, and what I discovered as I was reflecting and pulling together a presentation, that I lived in a constant state of fear. You know, I was fearful that I couldn't make it in sales. I was fearful that I couldn't run my own business. I was fearful that even if I had a good month selling, that the next month wouldn't be good. You know, I was fearful if my new product came out, nobody would want to buy it. I mean, to me, being an entrepreneur is living in a world of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and it's the hardest thing in the whole wide world. And the key to success is to be able to live through it and to keep going despite how you're feeling and to get there. My whole business was actually wiped out in the year 2000, and I had to start from scratch again. Even after having many successful years, it was totally wiped out. And so, I mean, I had to rise again, you know, like the phoenix, and figure out where my place was in the world and how to create a new business model.
How did you do this, Jill? Let's get very specific. This will really help our listeners. I always talk about OPM, other people's money, but I also coined the phrase OPE, other people's experiences. And I think it would be great if you could be specific. You know, you lose these two Wall Street clients, and what eventually you did that helped you rise from the phoenix and get you back to where you are today?
Well, I actually spent a couple, you know, some time walking through the valley of death, I must say. I had just turned 50 years old, and I thought maybe I was over the hill and didn't have anything to offer the world, and I got real scared. I tried to go forward, and I couldn't go forward, and it took me a while to really sort out what I was really passionate about. And once I could figure out what I was passionate about, then I could start seeing the way forward. And I had just gotten my business going again and was starting to get my consulting clients back, and things were really starting to happen when I did a pro bono project for somebody else for a Ventures magazine on small and emerging businesses. That's what they were for. And they asked me to help them with their media kit. And I said, well, I don't know a lot about entrepreneurial firms, so give me some data. So they gave me information, and I was reading a stack of data. I went, oh, my God. Now, this is where the strength of the economy is. This is where people, you know, it's a robust growth engine. It's where all new accomplishments are coming from. It's like it's the most wonderful part of the economy. I know nothing about it. And, you know, this huge amount of entrepreneurs are closing their businesses because they're not making enough money. Not like they're in, you know, bankruptcy or anything. They're just not making enough money. And because I come from a sales background, now I go, whoa, dang, they don't know how to sell. And so I literally spent 3 months of my life studying what entrepreneurs were learning about selling and where they were getting their information. I discovered the internet was just a horrible resource, and that a lot of the books that were written were old and not working with today's corporate client. And so I spent 3 months studying that and saying, how can I help these entrepreneurs? How can I help them? And ultimately came up with an idea to start a website called Selling to Big Companies, which led to the book. And I launched that website in about 2003, 2004, and my book was written in 2005, and then I've written another book since then. But it was an incredible journey. I mean, it wasn't where I thought I'd ever be going, but it's where I got taken. You know, sometimes I think you're taken places, and you can't necessarily direct how things happen.
Well, I remember once on this show, I'm going way back when Mark Victor Hansen and I were talking, and I've had Jack Canfield on, and we talked about Buckminster Fuller, and, you know, he talks about the reverse paranoid and that the universe is conspiring to do us good, but many times, you know, we don't know that. But as you said, it kind of led you to, you know, some real aha moments, and those aha moments have led to your latest book that's been out called Snap Selling. So I thought it would be great to dive into this, and maybe we can start off and you can tell us a little bit about what you mean by snap selling.
Yeah, let me just say that I write books when I run into problems, and I see that there are problems that are out there. And you know, my first book, Selling to Big Companies, was written to help small businesses get their foot in the door of bigger companies. And my second book, Snap Selling, was written because suddenly everybody I was dealing with personally in business was crazy busy. And I started seeing strange behaviors happening. You know, I would be out talking to a potential client, and they'd say, "Well, Jill, this is really good. We'd really love to do business with you. I think this is exactly spot on what we need." And then they'd say, "Well, I need to get permission, or I need to get talk with these people, or I need to get some approvals done, and we'll get back to you and get something set up." You know, so it was like a done deal. And then suddenly, I'd call them back about a week later or email them and say, "How are things going?" And I wouldn't hear back from them. I'd email them again, and I wouldn't hear back from them. I'd email them another time, and I wouldn't hear back from them. And then I'd think, well, did I misread this thing? You know, I could have sworn that he said he was interested. And so then I'd, try again. And after a while, I started to think, I must have really blown it. I mean, I must have really screwed up along the way because I'm not hearing from him. And then suddenly, 2 months later, out of the blue, they'd get back to me and say, "Sorry, Jill, something else came up. I didn't have time to get back to you, and I knew you could wait." I was like, whoa, that's new. He didn't have time to get back to me. Out of all those calls and emails that I sent, he was too busy to even get back to me, or didn't think he needed to. That's the other thing. He didn't think he needed to. It was my responsibility to be the visible thorn in his side in terms of he wanted to move forward with me, but he took no responsibility for it and totally abdicated everything to me. So this is the kind of behavior I was seeing out there, and this is really weird. And then I started reading and studying the effect of being crazy busy and discovered all sorts of ways that it impacted people, like irritability or total distraction or short-term memory, that they didn't commit things to short-term memory, and they might say, yeah, I'll send you that after we hang up, and then they'll never send it. But it's not because they didn't mean to. It's because they turned to the next task at hand, and suddenly they lost it. I mean, it was literally lost from their memory bank, and they didn't remember. So this is what SNAP is about, how to deal with crazy busy people, because it's so different from dealing with normal human beings who have all the time in the world.
Well, I think it's about that, but it's also a lot more. And I think back to when, you were early on in your selling career, and I remember obviously hearing an interview that you did with Seth Godin, and you talk about, dealing with a client and literally going in the hallway and fainting and, get out of here and never come back. And I think even from that day to today, things are really changing, and I think that's a big part of SNAP selling, including even the acronym for SNAP. So maybe you can talk about this and some of the really big findings here above and beyond, working with crazy people. There's a lot that you need to do here to really get sales.
Yeah, there really is. And what I've done in SNAP selling is I've really broken the customer's decision process into three main areas. And the first decision they make regarding all of us entrepreneurs who are trying to reach them is they make the decision to give us access, which is really hard right now because they block themselves from us. They don't want to be interrupted. The second decision they make is a decision to change from the status quo, which when you're crazy busy is the last decision in the world you want to make. You only change from the status quo for good reason. And then the final decision, after they've decided to change from the status quo, then they decide which vendor they're going to use. So there are three primary decisions that people who sell are being engaged in, and the first one is the one to get the appointment. But what I did is I found out when I analyzed what was going on and what it took to be successful with crazy busy people is that there were four factors that they were constantly considering and juggling in their mind the entire time. And they played themselves out differently at each of the decisions that they made, but they were always there. And that's SNAP is an acronym for these four factors that were constantly being evaluated in their interactions with the seller. And the first, the S in SNAP stands for simple. And crazy busy people can't handle complexity at all. So when things get complicated for them, they will back off. Even something as simple as a long email message is complicated to them. And it's like, oh, I can't handle this long email, you know, so they don't read it, or they put it there someplace else to handle later. So simple is a criteria that's in their mind. You have to make things simple if you want to gain access to them, if you want to help them see if making a change would be good, and then if you want to be chosen. And this is something nobody has ever thought about in sales. How can I continually make things simple, easier for my prospect, easier for them to decide, easier for them to understand, easier for them to explain to others? And it's a really big emerging trend in sales. The N in SNAP, so we've got simple, and the N in SNAP is invaluable. And it starts out with a little tiny I, then a big N, invaluable. But this is the other hugely emerging trend in selling. People who are very busy don't want to deal with a rookie. They don't want to deal with somebody who doesn't know a lot. They want to deal with an expert, somebody who's smart and savvy and who can bring them fresh ideas, insights into their market, information that they might find valuable, information like how other customers are doing it, trends in the marketplace, studies, research. They're really looking for a smart person to work with, somebody who's not just smart at selling or not just smart about their product or service, but is focused on leveraging their smarts to help the customer. That's being invaluable, leveraging what they know or the resources they have access to help their customer achieve their objectives. So the N is hugely growing in importance, because in a world of copycat products and look-alike services, the only difference then becomes the seller. Who's bringing it to the table better? Who's worth working with? And if nobody is worth working with, by the way, if nobody brings anything else to the table, then they're going to go with the cheapest provider out there.
So let's go to A, then, and then we'll go to P.
Okay. A is aligned. If you're dealing with the corporate market, they want to know immediately that you're aligned with their business objectives. And a lot of people think we're there to sell our products, but they don't buy our products because they want them. They only buy them because they serve a purpose. For example, I sell sales training, and there's not one corporation in the U.S. or the world, I think, that gets up, you know, VP of sales gets up in the morning and stretches and says, oh, man, I'd really love to bring in a sales trainer. You know, I'd like to spend a ton of money, bring all my people in from out of the field. You know, that I just want to do that. Nobody does that. You know, so if I call up and say I specialize in sales training, nobody could care less, because that's not their objective. They're not measured on, did you do sales training this year? What they're measured on, my buyer is measured on sales revenue. And they're measured on new client acquisition and their profitability of the sale. They're measured on, and they're constantly tracking the length of the sales cycle. So what we have to do is we have to learn to talk in the language of the person we're trying to attract as a buyer, as a customer. And rather than calling and, you know, letting people know you do training, I have to call and talk about new client acquisition as my key strategy. And so people don't do that. They still are stuck in the, well, I sell this service, or I sell this product, or we offer a full line of XYZ, or we one-stop shopping for this, or we have wonderful service, and nobody could care less about that, you know? We have to focus on alignment, which is their business objectives, and that's got to be, you know, that's got to be what we talk about all the time. It's about them, not us. And then finally, the P is priorities. What is most urgent, top of mind right now on their plate? And priorities shift based on a whole slew of different things. There are, for example, in the northeast part of the U.S. right now, with all the flooding, everything else that was important isn't important anymore. All these businesses that were maybe focused on, you know, increasing revenue right now are focused on cleaning out their offices. And so the key is we have to realize that priorities shift rapidly. And that's an external thing that affected their business, but also there are internal things like a new change in leadership, the fact that they may have there may be a merger, or third quarter earnings came out and they were stagnant. And suddenly people's priorities shift when these things happen. And so we need to be aware of what are their priorities. And we can know this either by researching the company or knowing the industry or knowing the certain type of decision maker that we're working with all the time, like I do VP of sales, and knowing what's on their, you know, what's top of mind for them at all times.
Well, I think that SNAP acronym really says it all. And again, listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Let's Talk Business. And we're talking with author and speaker and strategist and a woman that knows an awful lot about selling. And it is none other than Jill Conrath. And she has a new book that's been out for a while called Snap Selling that I highly recommend that you go out and get. And, you know, Jill, this is going to sound like a funny question, but I think in the end it actually won't be. And that is, what is sales?
That's a good question. And it is really hard to define, but to me, sales is a function where you look to find a good fit between your product and service and a company's needs. And it's really, you do better in sales if you focus on your prospect's needs than if you do about making the sale, if that makes any sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think, you know, as you've said in the past, you know, it's the outcome that matters and not a goal.
Right. You will get sales if you focus on your prospects' needs and if you're focused on the SNAP factors, like, you know, making things simple for your prospects and being an invaluable resource and being aligned with what they're doing and focusing on their priorities. You will get business when you do that. If you go out and try to sell, you will run into roadblocks all the time because people's mindset on selling, if they look at the way they think about it, is it's really about convincing and manipulating and, you know, persuading. It's not. It's really about focusing on helping somebody achieve what they want to achieve, and then the business comes right along with that.
Well, I think the fact of the matter is you know, that the old days, the way things were sold are long gone, and I think your studies and homework and findings and book is, pardon the pun, snap on. And I think the fact I think the fact of the matter is those are salespeople out there that stick to what they used to do. Obviously, you know, they won't survive. And, you know, it actually brings up an interesting question, and that is, you know, are salespeople born or made?
Oh, let me just say right now, they are made because sales is a skill that can be learned. And everybody can learn the skill. Not everybody chooses to, and some people say, I hate it, I'm not a salesperson. But sales can be learned. I am a perfect example of it. I hated sales. I didn't want to do it. I learned it and discovered it was actually quite fun because it's really about working with customers, you know, and prospects and helping them achieve their goals. Now, I can do that all day long. But I thought it was something else, and I had to learn what it took to bring my best expertise to people or my best products to people so that they could understand how to run their business better. It's learned. Some people are, it's easier for them and it is more natural, but to throw up your arms and say, I'm not a sales kind of person, is a fundamental mistake. And entrepreneurs that do that are abdicating responsibility for the success of their business.
Amen. And it's critical, especially in the beginning. And, you know, one of the things that there's just an aura about this whole subject, and that is the fact of the matter is that you have to deeply, deeply care about your customer, and it's not about you. And you need to recognize that not everyone is a customer.
Right. And that's okay. And we want to think that everybody is a potential customer for us. And actually, that mindset gets you in so much trouble. First of all, it gets you in trouble because you don't have the appropriate focus to be the expert that you need to be today. You know, if you're trying to sell to everybody and you're trying to go to a school district one day and a government, you know, a county government office the next day, and then you're trying to go to a manufacturing plant, and then you try to go to a law firm. I mean, you can't be good at any of that stuff.
No, you can't. You can't be. And, you know, when I sum it all up and I think about, you know, not only this book and selling and all the great sales, you know, people out there and the sales books and gurus and, you know, there's no shortage of books out there, as we both know. And I think in a conversation that you had, I think eventually the whole key here, Jill, to a large extent, is you really have to make yourself indispensable.
Yes.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you do this.
Well, I really think you need to think about things from your, again, from your prospect's point of view. And let me just give an example of somebody who might sell promotional products, okay? Because there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there selling promotional products. And by the way, promotional products are, you know, keychains and mugs and other things that people use for trade shows and to attract customers and as bonus products, et cetera. And you can go and get those online. You don't need a salesperson anymore to come out to show you what are the cool things that are available for promotional products. However, somebody who really wants to be in this business, if they can become an expert on how to leverage promotional products to achieve business results, they're going to have work all the time because they're going to be able to contact the safety director and say, look, I know that accidents are a real cause of concern and that workman's compensation is of high cost. I've got some ideas that might help you increase the safety in your plant. Now, they're bringing in the promotional products as the byproduct, but their focus is on being an invaluable resource. They're only using the promotional products to help the safety director cut accidents in the plant. That's a whole lot different than calling up and saying, I've got some promotional products. Can I show them to you? It's a whole focus difference in terms of, you know, your intention and your expertise and being an invaluable resource.
Well, I think it's really key, and you know, there's so many other things in the book I really enjoyed. Again, listeners, the book is called Snap Selling, Speed Up Sales, and Win More Business with Today's Frazzled Customers. And that's what I wanted to kind of talk about here, that as we know, like never before, people's attention spans are razor thin, and prospects are extremely busy. And I thought, Jill, maybe it'd be great for you to really help the entrepreneurs out there, the business owners, and maybe give them some advice on and how to get real attention from prospects and even cut through the clutter.
Let's take the fact that you would like to set up a meeting with somebody, and that person that you're calling, you want to capture their attention via a phone message. And so what you do is you have your nice, gracious message because you're an entrepreneur and you don't want to sound like a salesperson, okay? Because most entrepreneurs hate to sell, so that's why, we don't want to be pushy, one of those pushy people. Okay, now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to listen as if you're that crazy, busy person that I'm trying to reach. And here's your assignment. I want you to yell out, delete, the minute you delete this voicemail message. And everybody else who's listening too, I want you all to think about when you delete this message, the nicest message in the world. Hi, Mitch. This is Jill Conrad calling. I'm with Leapfrog Strategies. And the reason I'm calling today is that we specialize in offering a full range of sales training programs for all your company's needs. And the reason I'm calling is I'd love to set up a time to meet with you. You haven't deleted me yet?
I tell you what, I'm deleting you right now.
Well, most people have deleted me, by the way, when I say, hi, I'm Jill Conrad. I'm the account executive at XYZ Company, or I'm the president of Leapfrog Strategies. As I go, Leapfrog Strategies, I don't know them. Delete. Or that you say, Leapfrog Strategies, we specialize in offering a full range of, and then they go delete. Because then they know you're a salesperson, and they don't want to do it. But that's the gracious message, and it just got you into delete trouble because you're buying 5 to 7 seconds of that person's time. So here's what you can do. Here's another example, okay? And this is a switch, and this is being a business professional who understands what I'm bringing to the table. Hi, Mitch, Jill Conrad calling. Say, I know that as VP of sales for your small company, one of the key challenges you're facing is new client acquisition. I've got some ideas that might be helpful. Can we set up a time to talk?
Short and sweet. Simple.
Did I even tell you what company?
No.
Got right to the point? Sounded like a professional, didn't I?
Very professional. And as you kind of point out, as you and I both know, some people don't even like a voicemail, you know, they might want email. And as you said, you know, you don't want to make emails too long as well. And you don't want to give up on the sale, too. People are so frazzled, you got to really stay after them. It's staggering, huh, Jill?
Yeah, what people don't realize, they say, well, I tried calling 3 times and they didn't get back, or I tried calling or leaving, I've sent them 5 emails, haven't heard back from them. A couple things I'd say to that. Number one, they're probably doing the nice, gracious message, and they're getting themselves deleted, so they've got to learn how to redo their message so that it is more effective. And secondarily, they need to put together a campaign, and they need to think in terms of 10 to 12 contacts in order to before they move on and put people on a quarterly basis. And how often should those contacts be? at least once a week, if not more. People don't remember that you contacted them.
Now, you got to be awfully persistent, and, you know, the market is crowded, and I learned a lot from you in preparing, including reading the book, and, you know, you said it well in that, you know, people don't need a salesperson. Everything that they could want to know is online, and they really need someone that really cares about them and can help them. And as we both know, social media can be good, but there's also some downsides to it, and I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, certainly there are some downsides, but to me there's a lot more upsides than that. I mean, if you're not doing well, it's certainly broadcast widely on social media. And by social media, I'm talking perhaps Twitter is probably the one that, you know, is big right now. And other people might blog about it on their own blogs if you haven't done a good job serving them. But honestly, for the small business, I truly believe that blogging, YouTube, and tweeting are probably, and I would go blogging and YouTube number one and two, or, you know, back and forth, are the two things that are levelers for small businesses. And if you can get on, you know, if you can develop some professional videos that are one or 2 minutes in length that talk about some of the issues that your clients are facing, to address some challenges, to how to make decisions, and talk about things that are of interest to people, and have your website become a hub of information, you're going to be found, and they're going to want to work with you. And a lot of small businesses think they can't compete with this, but honestly, it's an evener. I mean, it puts you, if you focus on creating an information-rich website with good content on it, not about your stuff, good content from my perspective as a customer, then you really will be not only attracting me into your world, you'll be getting me looking at your website and going, oh, they really know what they're talking about. This is interesting stuff. You know, I need to talk to these people. And so being online and having a strong website with good content that's educational in nature is really, really important. Not pitching your stuff, but being educational and informative.
Well, that information is key. And listeners, you can get some great information at Jill's website at www.jillkonrath.com. She also has other websites as well, sellingtobigcompanies.com.
Can I stop you there? Everything's going to be merged in another week onto jillkonrath.com.
Okay,
so
again,
it's going to be the hub, and it's Conrath with a K.
Yes. And you listeners, I know, will really enjoy, including even downloading her interview with Seth Godin. Well, I tell you what, Jill, I never know where the time goes here. And in wrapping up, you know, one of the things that's really critical in selling, and sometimes it's overlooked, is the process of asking questions, and good questions, and insightful questions. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about this and what's next for Jill Conrath with a K.
To me, questions are the key once you get inside the account, but you have to earn the right to get there based on, like, what I was telling you before. But at that point, your questions are what helps your prospect determine if you are really somebody who knows his or her stuff. And so people, I really strongly suggest that they put together a list of 10 questions before they go into a call, and honestly feel comfortable taking the questions in, not to interview the person, but to put on top of their notepad when they're taking notes and you know, talking to the person. And basically, when you go in to meet with somebody, it's an introduction with yourself, and basically, you know, my company does this, and give an example and say, but, you know, the truth is we're here to see if this makes a difference for you, and I prepared some questions that I'd like to ask you. And usually they'll be totally fine with it, and then you have your questions there and you can do it. And the reason I'm telling you right now to bring in a list is that, again, we go back to research on the brain. The brain is incapable of doing two things concurrently. So your brain either has a choice of listening to the person who's talking or thinking of the next question. And when you're under pressure in sales, you're focusing on the next question or listening. You can't do both. So you've got to have the questions thought about ahead of time. And the best questions focus, you know, certainly on understanding where the company is going, where the organization is going, the strategic directions that they're trying to achieve, and where is the gap between where they want to be and where they are today. And then trying to find out if what you can do can help close that gap in any shape, form, or manner.
And that's extremely important, and I think it plays back to, you know, the whole art of selling and really caring about the customer. Real quickly, Jill, what's next?
What's next? Fear. fear. That's what's next. And when I say that, it's the unspoken thing. Nobody talks about how to deal with the fear, and it's the ability to get through the fear. I think that is a skill. It's a skill set that people can learn how to leverage. And once they learn how to leverage it, they develop a fear muscle, and then they can go into these periods of fear, uncertainty, and doubt stronger and go through it. And life is full of new occasions and just keeps rising you up once you learn how to deal with that.
Well, for a whole other show, we'll bring you back and we'll discuss getting through it. And I tell you what, I thoroughly enjoyed having you on today. I really enjoyed Snap Selling. And I'm glad we didn't get deleted here. And, and more importantly, hopefully you enjoyed yourself today.
It was a lot of fun talking.
Okay. Again, listeners, go out and get Jill Conrath's book, Snap Selling. I know you're thoroughly going to enjoy it. Go to her all-encompassing website here real shortly. That's JillKonrath.com. And, of course, I want to thank everyone that makes this show possible. I want to thank everyone here at WREK, of course. I want to thank Grace. I want to thank, of course, our engineer Fred and so many others, Jonathan, and all the people that are behind this show, especially everyone at Accent. Go to their website, accent.com, a great software company that really gets the whole concept of being a good company and making a difference for others, especially our youth. And always feel free to send email to mitch@ltbn.com. I'd love to help you. Go to the first ever comprehensive support network for entrepreneurs, the Let's Talk Business Network, and some of the other things we're doing, including bringing the Epicenter to Atlanta for the home of the Entrepreneur Hall of Fame at www.theehalloffame.com. That's the ehalloffame.com. And as I said earlier, this show is all about entrepreneurship, and it's also about the dreaming, and it's time for us dreamers, yes, to unite. Bye-bye now.